From the Netherlands, this is the Green Planet Monitor, voices and stories from a warm, wet planet. Today, sleeping and dreaming, essential and mysterious.
Fundamentally, sleep is by the brain and for the brain. Brains rewire at night. Our neurochemistry changes dramatically, and connections are formed in the brain to optimize function for the following day.
An old Tanzanian friend speaks about heavy rains and village celebrations.
Oh, in the village we have traditional dances. We have trumpets, we have traditional drums, we have guitars. After the harvest, we normally get together to celebrate, to eat, to drink together. People tell stories. Of course, we don't have books in the villages, but we have old people who give stories.
And in the Dutch city of Delft, a big university goes geothermal.
Yeah, so we're drilling now 2.1 kilometers and retrieve hot water. There is heat exchangers at surface. So we take out the heat. With the heat, we want to heat the campus buildings of the university, and outside 5,000 to 10,000 houses of the city of Delft will be heated with that.
This is the Green Planet Monitor. I'm David Kattenberg. Before diving in, a request. Help us deliver this weekly package of Earth news. Subscribe at greenplanetmonitor.net. Few things in life are more precious than a good night's sleep. 6 or 7 hours of shut-eye, punctuated by brief visits to the loo, better yet, sleep filled with pleasant dreams. Drifting off in the middle of an important meeting or behind the wheel of your car is an entirely different story. This past week, scientists reported that nesting chinstrap penguins nod off for a few seconds 10,000 times every day, all the better to keep an eye on their nestlings. I spoke about this most cherished and mysterious activities with Brian Murray. Murray is a sleep neurologist at Sunnybrook Hospital and Research Institute in Toronto.
Sleep is a behavior, a reversible disengagement from an unresponsiveness to the environment. And you lie down and you're quiet and your eyes are closed. That's how we can quantify sleep in animals. In humans, sleep plays many roles. Some of these roles are fundamental to sleep, and others nature has tacked on as a bonus. So fundamentally, sleep is by the brain and for the brain. Brains rewire at night. Our neurochemistry changes dramatically, and connections are formed in the brain to optimize function for the following day. Along with that function, other biological processes benefit. Many systems in the body benefit from sleep. For example, our endocrine system, our immune system. So the fundamental role of sleep is for the brain, but many other health systems benefit.
And why does the brain need that?
Well, the leading thought about what happens in sleep is that over the course of the day, our brains form many new connections. We learn many new things. We acquire new knowledge. The brain has a limited capacity. There are only so many neurons that can connect in so many ways. We only have so much energy to do so. So over sleep, something has to give. And so less important or less relevant material gets washed away. And then the relatively important stuff stays connected.
And sometimes things actually get washed away literally by the cerebrospinal fluid. There's an exchange?
There isn't really a formal lymphatic system in the brain, a place to clear waste material. But in the brain, there is a space called the glymphatic space. It's a potential space in between the glial, the supporting cells in the brain, and blood vessels. And at night, the space opens up dramatically and opens up a space that can clear away toxic debris. So the animal models have shown, for example, that if you keep animals with a particular mutation awake, they accumulate amyloid, the neuropeptide responsible for Alzheimer's disease. If you stay awake long enough, you just fill up with this debris. If you sleep, then there's a clearing of this material in animal models. We think probably similar kinds of things occur in humans.
So getting back to the rewiring of the brain, I've read that sleep is kind of like a model for cortical plasticity, that the cortex is plastic and we're interested in this plasticity, but in sleep, we're actually seeing plasticity in action. Can you describe it?
Absolutely. So the brain is a plastic organ. It adapts and changes, and much of this adaptation occurs through sleep. A number of neuropsychological studies support this. For example, if you stay awake practicing a visual, spatial, perceptual task, you get a little bit better. But if you take a nap and you get sleep, all of a sudden you get way better. Other studies have shown that if you, you know, practice a movement, such as learning an adapted movement that might be important in, say, rehabilitation, and you practice this movement over and over, that part of your brain actually sleeps more. The area of the brain that subsumes that activity. And so we see more intense deep sleep in that region of the brain, and that correlates with the improved function the next day.
What makes a person actually fall asleep? What triggers sleep? What happens at that moment when suddenly you start to feel sleepy and then you fall asleep?
Well, there are a number of chemical changes in the brain that occur with sleep that follow a circadian cycle, a time of day, light, dark cycle. There are a number of changes that occur in each of the different stages. So as you enter non-REM sleep, your body starts to reduce the amount of acetylcholine and the amount of adrenergic neurotransmitters in the brain.
These are the chemicals that enable neurons to communicate with each other.
Right. And then in REM sleep, all of a sudden, the cholinergic tone is very high and the aminergic tone is low. And so we see these differences that cycle. In humans, we have a 90-minute non-REM cycle that repeats 4 or 5 times throughout the night. The state is also controlled by an important neuropeptide called orexin, which is a stabilizing neuropeptide. So it helps keep you in one state or in another. Patients with narcolepsy, for example, they don't have orexin signaling, so they transition between states rapidly. So they're awake, and then they become very sleepy. Or in some situations, they may be partially awake and partially asleep. So that's the basic neurochemistry of sleep.
What is it that triggers it? Like when you're lying there, you're awake, and then you're relaxed. Let's suppose that you're a good sleeper, and then mm-hmm. at a certain point, you start to get drowsy, and then you're gone.
Well, that flip-flop switch has flipped. So, you know, really, each of these states in and of themselves are great where they are. The problem is where we have transitions, and orexin is one of the key neuropeptides that helps stabilize a state. So when orexin starts to fall, then we start to see these unusual transitions into different states. The genes of circadian rhythms are another important facet of sleep-wake control.
Tell me about that. What role do genes play, a person's genetics play in the ability to sleep or the inability to sleep?
The genes that control sleep-wake behaviors are highly conserved evolutionarily. The fruit fly has light-dark cycle sensitivity. All through biology, we see examples of things that respect a light-dark cycle. So it's obviously fundamentally very important to our being.
That when the sun goes down, things get dark, it's time to fall asleep.
Right. Except for nocturnal animals, where it's reversed. But there, that has some evolutionary advantage to them. But in humans, you know, the remarkable thing is we have a number of clock genes. Every cell in our body has a little molecular clock that spins around a 24-hour cycle, which is really quite remarkable to think about. Like your liver cell in a dish will have a 24-hour cycle that starts to peter out after some days, but it's entrained by the brain. So the light enters the brain through a path called the retinohypothalamic tract. So the light comes in and trains the brain state, and then that signal is transmitted to all the other cells in our body to maintain this 24-hour cycle. So if you don't have the light input, other systems can take over. For example, in blind individuals, the timing of feeding can help entrain a circadian rhythm, a time-of-day rhythm. But in general, if you've got light entering the brain, that is the most dominant reset of the cycle. But the really amazing thing is that given the number of clock genes that we have, very small genetic mutations can create significant behavioral impact. So about 15 years ago, the first report of a genetic variation in one of the clock genes was associated with a human sleep disorder. So there's a condition called human advanced sleep phase syndrome, where people tend to go to bed much earlier. And there are examples of this. You look in families, there are night owls and morning larks, and it tends to run genetically. And in this one example, they identified that a single codon mutation, the tiniest bit of genetic information flipped, could shift somebody's social structure 4 hours. So the timing of their preferred activities, when they like to get up and go to bed, when their biological rhythms manifest various hormones. A remarkably complex impact from a single codon. Remarkable to consider that such a complex behavior could be determined so simply.
Within a gene that's expressed in lots of different tissues around the body.
Yes.
And how about dreaming? What's dreaming all about? I'd like you to go into this idea that you can actually hear in your lab, you can actually observe the electrical patterns associated with dreaming. Presumably, one can actually stimulate dreaming.
Yes. So we really don't know at this point what the function of REM sleep is. A number of physiologic things happen. You're essentially paralyzed, so you don't enact your dreams. That's a good thing. But there's a condition where humans actually do enact dreams. And it can be a warning sign for neurodegenerative conditions in the brain.
So in other words, while they're dreaming, they're problem. Walking around and doing things.
They can. So normally we're paralyzed. We have rapid eye movements. You can observe that. Breathing tends to be irregular. So conditions like sleep apnea tend to get worse in REM sleep.
And REM sleep is when you're dreaming.
Yes. Although you can dream in non-REM sleep as well. The types of dreams that you have in non-REM or REM are very different, though. In REM sleep, your frontal cortex is relatively deactivated, so there's no sensor there. So the lapses in logic in a dream just seem appropriate at that state. On the other hand, we also get vivid, colorful images, lots of movement. So associative areas of the cortex, which associate with say a vision with movement or other senses, is very active. So the dreams are illogical, colorful, they're associated with intense emotion. The limbic system of the brain is very active in REM sleep.
The emotional brain.
That's right. On the other hand, in non-REM, if you wake people up out of non-REM, sometimes they report repetitive thoughts or ideas. They're not the dreams that we typically think of as being dreams, but sometimes there's kind of a repetitive thought or idea or concern that pops into the mind. And so there is a type of dreaming that occurs in non-REM sleep as well, but it's different.
And lucid dreaming.
Lucid dreaming is interesting. It's an in-between state where people can feel like they're controlling their dreams. So people can report an epic dream where they're doing something for a prolonged period of time, and they can kind of change the direction of where the dream is going or where they're physically going
so they're
in their mind.
They say, like, oh, when I was a kid, I would occasionally have dreams where I'd be extremely outrageous in the class and the teacher was going to punish me, but I knew that I was dreaming.
Right.
And I'd wake myself up, and it would make me feel really happy that I could tweak the nose of the teacher because I was just dreaming.
Yeah, lucid dreaming is an interesting state of partial transition between REM sleep and wakefulness. So I mentioned before this neuropeptide orexin helps stabilize state. So normally when we're in REM sleep, we're paralyzed and our breathing's irregular and our limbic system's active. When we're awake, we move around, our eyes are open. Sometimes those individual fibers in the brain subsisting each of those functions don't coordinate themselves and they don't work together. So when orexin's not present, we get partial states somewhere in between. And that can lead to problems. Lucid dreaming can be seen in patients with narcolepsy, for example, who are lacking orexin. But even normal people without narcolepsy who are severely sleep-deprived can get themselves into a state where they're prone to these rapid transitions between states, incomplete rapid transitions.
I mean, this is like the age-old question. Does dreaming have a purpose or a significance? Or is it just an artifact, as it were, of just strange rewiring patterns, and it just happens to, strange phenomena that happens, it has no purpose or objective, if you will.
So sleep itself is fundamentally important for the brain, but what actually happens in REM sleep, what the purpose or reason for that is not clear. It does seem to be a biological artifact, but we really don't know.
So dreaming would appear to be a biological artifact, you're
saying? I think so.
Yeah. It's kind of disappointing for people who like to interpret their dreams.
Yeah, well, it's interesting.
They have a little notebook by the table, the bed table, and they're journaling their dreams.
Well, the contents of the dream do reflect some things that occur in the day. So oftentimes, you know, if something's been occurring frequently, you know, a lot of the cortex is busy processing that information, so that content may come out in the dream state. But what the dream itself means, who knows? I think it's probably an artifact of that information without the frontal lobes there to kind of walk through it in a logical manner.
Insomnia. You can't fall asleep. I can't fall asleep at night. I actually have difficulty falling asleep at night, but it's very common.
Yeah.
What are the causes of insomnia?
So insomnia is a really common condition. It's one of the top 10 presenting reasons to see a family physician. And sometimes it's transient. It's related to a stressful event. Other times it's chronic. When it's chronic, we need to make sure that there isn't an underlying medical reason for it. Conditions such as the restless leg syndrome can interfere with sleep onset and produce insomnia. So that's a common contributor to that, that's not always identified. Behavioral factors contribute far more commonly to sleep initiation troubles. So, for example, eating too close to bedtime, not having a dark, quiet room, not keeping a routine.
Too much screen time.
Screen time. So light activates the retinal hypothalamic tract in the brain. So if you're looking at a light source, a computer screen up close, close to bedtime, it's sending a signal to your brain to wake up, the opposite of what you want at bedtime. So those are some of the many behavioral factors. Caffeine, for example, another thing. Alcohol. Alcohol can fool you because it will hasten sleep onset, but the sleep that follows is often very fragmented and discontinuous. Probably a lot of that has to do with triggering sleep disordered breathing. So alcohol relaxes the upper airway, and people snore more, and then they're more prone to wake up from these respiratory events.
So sleep fragmentation and insomnia in general are not good for your health, generally speaking.
Well, there have been studies looking at sleep fragmentation predicting worse cognitive outcome over a period of time. Certainly sleep disorders can fragment sleep and create trouble. Somebody with sleep apnea and a low blood oxygen to the brain is going to create problems. In and of itself, the sleep fragmentation is probably significant. But research in this is hard to do. You have to study people over long periods of time and have ways of quantifying the sleep effects on the brain function. Each in and of themselves, difficult measurement problems. But the information continues to accrue. It makes sense. It's biologically, it seems somewhat obvious. I mean, you know, sleep has got to be important for your health. Why would we spend a third of our lives doing it otherwise?
Brian Murray is a sleep neurologist at Sunnybrook Hospital and Research Institute in Toronto. Read more about his research interests and sleep at greenplanetmonitor.net. While you're there, subscribe. With your help, we'll keep delivering stories about planet Earth, human development, justice, and science to listen to, read, and watch. Dar es Salaam, Tanzania's largest city and Africa's fourth largest port on the edge of the Indian Ocean, is a funky town. Under the dual influence of El Niño, originating in the Pacific, and the Indian Ocean dipole, Dar has been experiencing heavy rains and flooding these days. Stuck in your car or packed into a dala-dala minibus on a muddy road, getting from one side of Dar to another is always a challenge. No one knows more about this than one of the Green Planet Monitor's oldest friends, Josephat Mwanzi. I reached Josephat at home on the edge of Tanzania's City of Peace. So, Josephat, you work in Dar es Salaam, if I'm correct, but you live outside Dar es Salaam. Can you tell me where it is that you do work in Dar es Salaam, right?
Yes, I work in Dar es Salaam, and I live in Dar es Salaam too. So this is the city that I have been living in for more than 15 years now.
But you were telling me yesterday, we were trying to connect yesterday, and you had been at work and you were going home, and you were telling me that the traffic is terrible and it was going to take you a long time to get home. And I know the roads are really challenging. Can you tell me what the situation is in Dar es Salaam, like going back and forth between where you work and where you live? And there rains. It's very rainy at the moment.
Yes, it is very rainy. And I would say, Dave, that we have unusual rains at the moment. You know, Dar es Salaam is the largest city in Tanzania, and it is the most famous city in East Africa and the Central Africa, for it is a business city that provides services, business services to many countries around Tanzania. It is because of its geographical location that it is along the shores of Indian Ocean. And it is located on the coast. So in the area with the two rain seasons, and it is hot and humid sometimes, almost all the year around, with all slightly hotter and wetter period from November to April. That's the normal situation, or the normal weather. But during the rainy seasons, it is more reliable here to receive normal rains, and life goes on. But this time, Dar es Salaam is very vulnerable, I would say, because we have heavy rains since October. We have been receiving heavy, heavy rains, and they come with windy. It is so windy, and it has caused a lot of damage. So yesterday, I had planned to talk with you to have this conversation to be held yesterday, but I could not make it. It is because it was raining heavily in Dar es Salaam, and the rain came unexpectedly, because in the morning it was, the weather was favorable, it was good, and it was sunny. But from 13 p.m., the weather started changing and it rained heavily. Now, when it rains in Dar es Salaam, it always is a challenge, because the rain causes a lot of traffic jam. Cars, especially here, we have what we call dara dara, the small buses that is used by the public. It is a public transport means. So when it rains, the dara daras, these small buses, they face a lot of traffic jam, because we have some small roads that these buses sometimes want to use as shortcuts to town or away from the city. But when it rains, almost all cars tend to use the main roads. And this is because the main roads are safer, because they are tarmac, they are good.
Because the other roads, the smaller roads that the daladalas take, are not paved. They've got potholes that are so deep you can disappear into them.
Exactly. And some cars can get into muddy, and they cannot even to move out of it. That's the challenge. So as more cars come to use the main roads, the more traffic jams we have experienced. So that's what happened to me yesterday. From the city center to my place where I live, it is supposed to be almost 1 or 2 hours. It takes me about 2 hours to reach my place. But yesterday it was more than 6 hours.
And I mean, you said that you live inside Dar es Salaam, and it takes you an hour and a half to drive from work in downtown Dar es Salaam to home?
Yes, where I live, and it is where I'm talking with you from now. It's my place here. It is about 30 kilometers away from the city center. So yeah, I am almost, not almost, I am in the suburb of the center. I'm not away of the city center. So, and I am, my district or my province is within the center. So can imagine if I am within the surroundings of the city center, then something like that happens to me. So it is even worse to those who are outside the center.
So, Josephat, is the impression that these rains that are falling, that you were saying that they've started early? Normally they start in November, but they started earlier, and the winds are very strong. Is this because of climate change?
According to the TMA is what we call Tanzania Meteorological Authority, which is the legal authority in Tanzania to predict weather, to give information about weather and climate issues. They say that the current rains directly connected to El Nino influences, and that has caused these rains to come in that situation that we've experienced now. And many experts say that this is an impact of climate change. And they conclude that these rains are related to climate change because of the unpredictable patterns that come along with these rains.
And are these heavy rains causing damage to homes and causing problems with food production, agriculture?
They have caused the impact to, I would say, mainly two levels. One is the human impact to human people, people's lives. Then there is an impact that goes to the, what I would say, things, to the infrastructure, say, something like that, roads. So on the human lives, direct human lives, you find that these rains have caused some death. According to the official data, it shows that at least since October and now in November, about 5 people have died because of these rains in Dar es Salaam, but also in the near region called Lindi. Also there have been floods and have caused some death there, though the records of the status is not issued yet. But also it has increased the cost of food prices. For example, before these rains came, I would buy a kilo of rice at, say, it's about 200, of course it's about 50 cents or $1, USD dollar. And but now I can buy it. It is doubled, I would say. So the price of food is higher than normal at the moment. but also fuel, diesel is higher than normal. I have a car, but I have decided to park it for now. I cannot use it, my private car.
Because gas is too expensive.
The gas is too expensive for me to afford. So I have decided just to park it for now.
So then if you're not driving in your car, how are you traveling? You're taking a Dala-Dala?
I'm taking the Dala-Dala, the public transport. That's why you find I have to experience the challenges related to the public. But if I have my own car, then I can find my own shortcuts and ways to get to my place, to places where I want to.
And the Dala-Dalas are packed. I can imagine. I've traveled on Dala-Dalas and they're just packed like sardine cans.
Yeah, some of them have, because not some, almost all of them, when you get into the Dala-Dalas, full, very full packed. So, and sometimes it is very dangerous. We thank God that we don't have COVID-19 at the moment, but it is dangerous for even what we call the communicable diseases too. It is full. And I was talking about the other impact that I have noticed. It goes to the students, especially pupils, primary schools pupils. Because here in Dar es Salaam, you find pupils, girls and boys, have to travel longer distances going to school. So you find when it rains, it becomes very difficult for students and these pupils to go out and travel to go to school. Even coming back from school it's really challenging at the moment. So it has affected even the education system, because you find some parents tell their children not to go to school because they are afraid of the weather, which is unpredictable. Anything can happen to their children. So this affected the education development of the children at the moment.
Tell me where you're living, Josephat. I can see a room behind you. It looks like plaster walls, and the ceiling is wooden planks that are going this way and that, and it looks like you've got a zinc roof of some sort. Looks kind of interesting. Where do you live? What's your living situation like? And you were telling me that because of the rains, you were concerned that some embankment was going to break and your house was going to get flooded.
Yes. Where I'm living is really, the soil is, I don't know what can you call it. The soil is not salt. It is soft soil. The soil that we have around. And the rains has affected many people around, including myself, and my house also has been affected. And normally here we have fences which we build by blocks. So my fence fell down and caused a lot of challenges to me here. So as I speak now, I have some civil engineers. Two civil engineers outside who are working on my house, trying to cement the foundation around the area around my foundation to ensure that the rains should not continue damaging my house. But I have experienced the damage also of my house because of the rains.
And you own your house? Do you own your house?
I own it, and as you say, you see the roof behind me. It is under construction. So this is the roof that you see above me. It is the roof that I'm still working on. But it is very expensive to build a house in Dar es Salaam, and if you experience damages of this kind from rains, it is really very costful. I would say it is very costful and painful. And normally here, the government does not come along, come and help immediately until you really show evidence that you have been affected by the rains and that government is is liable to support you, because you have to deal with the situation on your own.
And what's your work situation like, Josephat? What are you doing to earn a living?
At the moment, I'm working as a consultant on research. I do help NGOs conduct audience research, but also some surveys that they want to carry out. For example, recently, I was working with the Women's Media Association. These are journalists, women journalists who have formed an association and are dealing with women journalist issues in the media. So they consulted me to carry out a research for them to find out how women are surviving financially in the media at the moment after COVID-19. And also I do help the media in Tanzania with the mentoring class. So I run trainings to journalists, especially younger journalists, but also I mentor them. So I earn a living in such a situation. But also I use some of my time teaching at the University of Dar es Salaam, teaching there as a tutorial assistant. And that helps me here and then to collect some money.
So you're earning an income, more or less.
Less, I would say it is less, because it is a seasonal. First of all, it is a seasonal. Yeah. It is not consistent. And even these opportunities are not available always. So I have to be very, very clever in saving whatever I aim. So also something like this here I'm doing with you, when I contribute my stories to Green Planet Monitor, I can get something that can help my family and my children, of course, with the school fees and something like that.
What's your family situation like? You've got a wife, you've got children?
Yes, I have a wife. Of course, she is not working at the moment, but she studied sociology, but it has been difficult for her to get a job. So she doesn't have a job yet. I have two children. One is 16 years old, Josephine. She's called Josephine. And the last one is Joanne, 3 years old. So I have, I would say, compared to my friends and other people that I see around me, I have a little bit small family. But as you know, Dave, in Africa, we have extended families. So I have some dependents that really depend on me, and they need my support. They need a hand to lift them up. So I have some dependents too, including my own mother, because my father died when I was still young. So I have the responsibility to take care of my mother too.
Josephat, we just have a few more minutes left. What do you guys do to entertain yourselves in your little village just on the edge of Dar es Salaam? Do you listen to music? Are there festivals?
Oh, in the village we have dances, traditional dances, what we call ngoma. We have trumpets, we have traditional drums, we have guitars, and we have some other traditional instruments that we use in entertaining ourselves. We have different ceremonies in the village. For example, when a family has a wedding, that is one of the ceremonies we have. During the harvest season, that means all families in the village at least have their own farms, small farms. So after the harvest, we normally get together to celebrate, to thank God, and to eat, to drink together. So during that time, we have a lot of dances, we have a lot of comedies, people read tell stories. Of course, we don't have books in the villages, but we have old people who give stories that are very inspiring and very compelling stories. Some of them are very thrilling. You know, they tell stories of old ages, and the young people play football, and we go racing, we run, something like that. So we have a lot of things that we are doing in the villages as collective. We have a communal life in the village.
Josephat, it's been a delight speaking with you, and it would be wonderful to have you on the Green Planet Monitor on a more or less regular basis, just as our correspondent in Dar es Salaam. Dar es Salaam is a kind of a funky city. I recall visiting Dar es Salaam, and it's got charm, it's got character.
Yes, I remember one of the stories that our audiences can go back to, one of my stories that I contributed was about the SGR. SGR is the standard gauge rail that was being built in Tanzania. Of course, it was a rapid transport project. And it was meant to reduce the traffic jam in Dar es Salaam.
And so has that been built? Is that rapid transit system now built in Dar es Salaam?
Yes, it is built, but it has not covered most of the area, which was expected to cover. So, of course, it has reduced to some extent the traffic jam in the city, but it has not covered many areas. So as a result, the traffic jam continues. But I remember it's now almost 10 years since I covered that story on the rapid transport in Dar es Salaam. And the then president was called Jakaya Kikwete, had told the people in Tanzania that transport system would eliminate the traffic jam in Dar es Salaam. Because by that time, the traffic jam was causing almost $1 million loss almost every month in Dar es Salaam because of the traffic jam. People are not reaching to work on time. Business are stuck always on the road, and transportation of the goods. For example, we have DRC. Countries like Rwanda, Burundi, DRC, Kenya, Botswana, Zambia, always depend on the harbor, Dar es Salaam harbor, to get business. But when it is there is a traffic jam, then it's a problem always for them. So to conclude this thought, I would say the rapid transport system that was meant to rescue the traffic jam in Dar es Salaam has not worked.
So much more to talk about, Josephat Mwanzi. We're running out of time here on Zoom, but you're going to come back on, and we're going to make this a more or less regular thing. So you take care out there in the heavy Tanzanian rains. And thank you so much for joining me on the Green Planet Monitor.
It has been a pleasure for me, as always, Dave. I thank you very much.
Josephat Mwanzi is a journalist and radio trainer based in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, in East Africa, and an old friend of the Green Planet Monitor. We're hoping to hear from Josephat regularly and pay him for his work for as little as $5 a month. You'll be helping us to do just that. Subscribe to this weekly package of Earth News at greenplanetmonitor.net. Each year, fossil fuel burning sends 37 billion metric tons of CO2 into Earth's atmosphere. A little over a tenth of those emissions, 4.1 billion tons, are associated with heating air and water in homes and buildings. So, clean ways to generate heat are in hot demand. Low electricity pumps pump heat from air to air, and from the ground. Then there's geothermal, piping water from beneath Earth's surface where water gets very hot. Hemmo Abels is an applied geologist with the Delft Geothermal Heat Project at the Technical University of Delft in the Netherlands. Two pipes are now being bored at TU Delft, a doublet they're called. 2.5 kilometers down, water temperature is 75 degrees and filled with natural gas. It'll get pumped up, the gas will be tapped, and the hot water will be used to heat campus buildings. Slightly cooler now, 50 degrees, that water will be sent through a grid to surrounding Delft homes. Total output, 8 megawatts of thermal energy. There are about 20 geothermal doublets around the Netherlands today. That could expand to 75 by 2025 and up to 700 by 2050, at which point the Netherlands is aiming to be CO2 emissions free. I spoke about the Delft Geothermal Heat Project with Hemmo Abels.
People are looking for sustainable energy, and the subsurface is one of the key sources. Hey. You see in the Netherlands that there is quite a public resistance growing towards windmills, solar panel farms.
Is there?
Yeah, because it uses space. I mean, people see the windmills, and if you work in the subsurface, you see after the now you see a big construction, but after the project, there's just two pipes basically coming out of the subsurface, and the rest is underground or in this building here next door, where the heat exchangers are. So what you hear now, we see a drilling rig that's around 45 meters high, and we are drilling down to 2.5 kilometers. Two deviated wells. One well is already finished. It goes to the east. It's 3 kilometers long, and it's around a kilometer to the site. And the other well going north, also around a kilometer deviated. So at depth, they are 1.5 kilometer apart, the two wells. And what we're doing is we want to produce hot water, as I said, 75 to 80 degrees water from the formation at that depth, and then cool it down here, take the heat out in this building in the back of it, and then bring the colder water back into the subsurface. And then in the subsurface, the two wells are communicating. In the back of us here, that's actually very interesting. We see this building here, this is from the 50s. And in the top here, those are coal hoppers. That's where coal used to be brought in. And then the campus was heated with coal. And then somewhere in the 70s, that was transformed to methane. So to gas, natural gas. And we hope in 2 years' time it will be all on sustainable heat from the subsurface, so on water.
This one building and lots of other buildings around campus.
Well, this is only the building to produce the heat. And it has been produced here since the 50s, using coal first and methane now. And it will be heating the whole campus. Not the newest buildings, because the newest buildings are very well insulated, and so they are heated at low temperatures. But the older buildings we have are not so insulated, and they are heated at higher temperatures. So we can heat those. And the rest of the heat we bring to older buildings around in the city of Delft, where also higher energy heat is needed to heat them.
You're drilling now. When is it going to be complete, and when it's complete, what will you be? Tell me about what you're planning on using this geothermal energy to heat.
Yeah, so we're drilling now. So we're drilling to 2.1 kilometers, a doublet system, where we retrieve hot water, a brine, in fact. So it's salt water that comes up. So there is heat exchangers at surface, and we send back to the same formation the same water. that's cooled down. So we take out the heat and the gas that's in there, and then we pump the water back into the same formation. So it's a closed system in that sense. And we, with the heat, we want to heat the campus buildings of the university and outside 5,000 to 10,000 houses of the city of Delft will be heated with that.
Which would save how much energy in terms of consumption of...
Yeah, I think it is 25 megawatt of energy. That's the whole system worth. In summertime, so you have a lot of months where you produce too much heat, because the heat demand of buildings is really focused on winter times and parts of the spring and parts of the fall. And then there's a lot of time where there's little heat demand and the well can still produce a lot of heat, the same amount of heat, of course. While in peak winter times, when it's really cold, then there is too much heat demand for the well. So what we also try to do is next summer, we will drill a whole set of extra less deep wells to 250 meters, where we will store the excess heat from the summertime for the peak moments of heat demand in winter.
You can actually heat up those aquifers.
Exactly, we heat up the shallow systems, the shallow aquifers. Also there we do a lot of research into how we can optimally do that, because such systems are normally not so efficient. Maybe you lose half of the heat that you pump in. So of course we want to optimize that to lose less, make it more efficient. So there is also a whole research component into that system. So something that's really needed is that there is more data gathering along with projects. Because what you can see in sustainable energy, that the margins are slim, and particularly these are low entropy systems.
So meaning low heat.
Low heat, yeah, exactly.
Low enthalpy.
Low enthalpy means low heat system. So economically, if you have a barrel of water of 75 degrees, well, if you wait too long, it's cold. So your money is gone. Eh? So it is very difficult to make an economic margin on a barrel of water. And it's much easier to make an economic margin on a barrel of oil. Because if you wait and the prices go up, you can sell it. And if the prices go down, you wait and you sell it later. So to make money with sustainable heat, with this kind of systems, is very difficult. So normally those companies, they gather as the minimal data possible, because data gathering is expensive. But it also means from each project, we learn little. And and it's difficult to optimize these systems because we have little knowledge and we learn little because the companies don't want to invest in data gathering. So,
and here we're talking about data on the subsurface, geology.
On the subsurface, but also on everything at surface, on scaling, on pumping, on pumps, and etc. These are all relatively new to a lot of engineers, but also there is little investments in science, in research into these kind of systems, because there is little money. Yeah, so it's good that the government is really boosting this now, or at least making money available to get more data and to get more science going, because we really need to, if we want the energy transition to really go faster and we want to move away from fossil energy, we really need a big boost of these systems. From multiple sides, it's a win-win, because it is a source of energy that we have in the first place. So if there is a energy crisis, prices go up, it is also economically worth it to invest in geothermal energy. And we have the climate crisis, so we really need to change from fossil fuels to sustainable sources. And well, so in that sense, it's a win-win.
Hemmo Abels is a geologist at the Technical University of Delft in the Netherlands. Read more about the Delft Geothermal Heat Project and geothermal heating in general at greenplanetmonitor.net. That's it for today's GPM, a listener-supported podcast coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions in the Netherlands. Listen, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube, and our home base, Blueberry. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, and Canada's Harbinger Media Network. Wherever or however you're listening, reading, or watching, please help us make the GPM happen. Subscribe and or donate at greenplanetmonitor.net. By the way, the guy behind this guitar is Dan Weisenberger. Thanks for your brilliant instrumental themes, Dan. I'm David Kattenberg. Over and out for now.